Members, we're going to get started. I don't think we're at quorum yet, but we should be sometime soon. Our first bill up today is House File 985, Representative Benson. We won't be able to move your bill just yet, but we could at least start the discussion with the committee.
All right. I will do that.
Let me know what.
Yes.
Morning, Representative Benson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much. I would like to.
We're going to hold off your motion until we have something.
Right. So I'll just discuss it. Right.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is a very simple bill, which I was asked to carry for the Board of School Administrators. And it has to do with giving them additional time to work on a whole series of rulemaking that they need to do, and the time was not sufficient. And that's basically all there is to this particular bill. But there is an amendment that Representative Ward is going to introduce. I don't know. Can we discuss that, or do we have to
certainly
wait?
We certainly may, Representative Benson. And you're referring to the A1 amendment?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
This, may I discuss it then?
Yes, absolutely. All right. We'll call on Representative Ward as well.
All right. This amendment simply protects or continues the present policy, which requires that administrators, principals, and superintendents have at least 3 years of successful teaching experience. And this, I believe, is the present rule. And this amendment is to ensure that that continues. For those of us who have been teachers, I can tell you that a great deal of credibility is added to any one administrative position if they have also had experience, practical experience, in the classroom.
Representative Ward, would you care to speak to your amendment as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and as Representative Benson said, the amendment, the reason that I'm offering the amendment is again, because just with more and more years of experience, I feel that that would make a more effective administrator, one that is, you know, the one that has substantially witnessed education,
yes,
from the ground roots up for a number of years. You know, as an educator, as a teacher, you know, after your first year of teaching, you know, that's a probationary period. It's like an on-the-job training thing, and I feel it's the same thing for administrator. The more time I believe an administrator spends in the classroom, I think the more effective they are as an administrator. So, and I hesitate to compare it to the corporate world, but if in the corporate world, if somebody came in with 1 year experience and wanted to go into a lead management position, most corporations, I don't think would see that as qualification and necessary requirements to be put in a position of a major leadership role. So keeping it at 3 years, I believe, is good for education, good for kids, good for staff, good for everybody. That's the purpose of the amendment.
So, Representative Ward, this is capturing current practice, but ensuring that as the rulemaking authority proceed, that this practice continue to be part of the.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Members, we do have a quorum, and so Representative Benson is going to move that House File 985 be recommended to pass. And Representative Benson, this will be going to K-12.
I believe it does.
Okay, so the recommended pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a re-referral to K-12 Finance. So your bill is before us, and Representative Ward moves the A-1 amendment. And so that is now before us, and we just had a brief discussion about it. We have a testifier, I believe, at the table who wishes to speak on the amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, Dr. Judith Lamp, Executive Director of Minnesota Board of School Administrators.
Welcome. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and give us,
yes,
your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dr. Judith M. Eaton Lamp, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of School Administrators. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I know this is going to go very quickly. The reason we're asking for the extension is we have completed all of the technical changes, such as changing the words Commissioner of Children, Family, Learning to Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Education. However, we need additional time in order to more thoroughly address several issues that have been identified in our discussions with various groups. We also believe that we must provide more time for input. Some of the identified issues are exactly what you were just talking about. That is an issue we believe we need more time to discuss, get greater input on. Strengthen the diversity competencies that we are looking at. Strengthen the talent and gifted competencies. And finally, and more fully develop the school safety competencies, which were mandated in last year's legislation. Thank you for your consideration of this request.
Thank you, Dr. Lamp, and we certainly do want to make sure that you're able to adequately cover those issues, and so I think there's I think there is a predisposition to allow for the extra time here.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
If I just can conclude, I just want to let the committee know that I have discussed this with Roger Arnson, who's legal counsel for the High School League. He supports the bill and the amendment.
Okay. Are there any further questions? Representative Erickson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would speak against the A1 amendment. I think we're taking away, for one thing, the flexibility that might be needed as we progress more into the 21st century for school administrators. I recall that hospital administrators do not have to be doctors. So I think there can be something refreshing about having school administrators who are well-trained, highly qualified, but not necessarily have taught in the classroom in a specific content area necessary to be placed in this rule. And, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, this already is in rule. Is that correct?
Dr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is the 3 years is already in the rule. The reason we were looking at reducing it to 1 year is to make it more fair to those potential administrators that go through the college university systems in our state. It is now feasible for someone to go an alternate route and not have to complete any of the competencies or any of the educational component. We're trying to make it fair but still keep the competencies higher. So consequently, if you look at the proposed competencies, they're dramatically increased, and everyone, regardless of whether it's 1 year or 3 year, would have to complete those competencies and show their skill level on them.
So, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier.
Representative.
Thank you. So in the rule, there's a one-year requirement, correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently it's 3 years.
Oh, it is three. And but your rule wants to change it to one.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. I would still speak against the amendment.
And I think Representative Ward, you wanted to, on this point.
I just wanted to clarify that, we just did have the clarification that it currently is 3 years. They're asking to change it to 1 year, and I still stand by my reasoning.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson.
I would like to speak against the proposed I want to speak in favor of the original amendment. I believe that if that probationary change would be made to 1 year, then I would be prepared to propose an amendment to have a probationary period of 1 year for teachers as well.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, the current Minneapolis Public Schools superintendent, who is widely respected and has brought some needed stability and strong leadership to the district, has never been a classroom teacher in the K-12 system. He's a college professor. I'm not sure what Augsburg's current status is. Is your intent to prohibit someone like that from stepping into a superintendency?
Representative Ward.
Representative Dabney, can you tell me, you said he's a college professor. Was he in the classroom of the college for a number of years?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, yes, he was, but of course would not have, you don't need a teaching license to teach at the university. Heck, most days it seems like you don't need much to teach at a university.
Representative Ward, we'll relay that message to the Committee on Higher Education. Representative Ward.
Representative Dabney, I'm not going to go there, but he did have classroom experience, and that to me is the important factor of being a lead administrator.
Representative Dabney.
The odd sound that you're hearing here is my agreeing with Representative Erickson. Our culture as teachers is that administrators, whether they be building level or district level, should have been teachers, darn it. And the kind of lore of incompetent teachers become administrators. And there's truth in that. Not by no means all. Before I get into any more trouble. But I'm open to good leaders coming into our schools who know their strengths and their weaknesses. And in the case of Dr. Green, he has hired a curriculum person, an excellent curriculum person, because he recognizes that while he has many strong leadership skills, he doesn't have the K-12 curriculum knowledge. So he's, as a strong leader, come in leading the organization and put together a team to lead the school district. I think that's what we want, whether that individual has spent 3 years in a K-12 classroom or not. So I'm agreeing with Representative Erickson, I think, for the first time this year, and maybe second, and we'll be voting no.
Mr. Chairman.
You got to love this committee.
Mr. Chairman.
That's right. I do want to hear from members in the audience on this issue, and then we'll get back to you, Representative Benson. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on this amendment? Ms. Salzwanger. Welcome, Ms. Salzwanger. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota, I must say that I do see some irony here in that you have to prove that you're a teacher and capable of continuing your contract by proving that you can teach 3 years successfully and go through 3 evaluations each year, and then you can be deemed a teacher who is able to keep their job. But then for this situation, you would be allowed to, you'd only be required to teach 1 year, and then you would be able to get an administrative license. So I just want to lay out that irony. And I would certainly support Representative Benson's suggestion that if this were to pass, that we have change the 3-year probationary period for teachers to 1 year.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I spent my career in the classroom, and one of the things I realized quickly was that a number of the members of the administrative cadre had little or no experience in the classroom, and yet, according to statute, unless I'm to be corrected, they are also the curriculum directors. Mm-hmm. In fact, they have final say on that. They have final say on selecting, for example, members of the faculty if they choose to have a leader of a particular department. Direct the curriculum. I always chafed under that, particularly when there were people in the administrative cadre who were, in my opinion, inexperienced and had very little knowledge in the subject matter. Besides that, I found it very difficult to convince some members, colleagues of my teaching staff, they ought to take seriously the curriculum leadership of someone who had never taught and who did not have a degree in the area in which they were directing us. Now, I had a master's degree in my subject matter, and yet I had to follow the direction of an administrator whose degree was administration and had no knowledge of the subject area in which I was teaching. But it did help a great deal to have an administrator who had had some experience in the classroom, as the teachers had. It really adds to their credibility, since they're to be leaders, curriculum leaders. So again, I would say I think it would be a very big mistake not to have people who are leading in curriculum not to have experience in the classroom as the teachers are required to. I just don't like that kind of hierarchical system. And so I'm very much in favor of the amendment to keep the rule, which was a good rule and has been on the books for many years, in place. If we want to get into the issue of not requiring people to have teaching certificates and allowing them to teach in a classroom, that might be a great discussion for another day. But right now, all we're attempting to do is provide extra time for the board to complete its work as it had been trying to do over the last few years, and to expand this now into changing these basic policies here in this committee, I think, is a mistake, and we have many other things we need to do. This is a simple little proposal to extend the time for the board, and I think we should leave it as that and not get into all these other issues. And I think I could argue that maybe it would be fine if we just dispense with teaching certificates entirely and all the rest of it, and simply let whomever we wish to come in and teach, because they may be competent in a particular field. It might be great for math and science, for example. But that's, I think, a debate for another day, Mr.
Members,
Chairman.
Members, we do have a room reserved for this evening. We have a number of bills before us. We can talk about this as long as you want, but we'll be back here at 6 p.m. to finish this agenda. Dr. Lamb wanted to comment. Mr. Aronson, I believe, wants to make a quick comment, and then Representative Heyer-Gerken has a question. Dr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is specifically why we're asking for extension. We need more time to discuss these issues, and I'm sorry I didn't mention that, the 1 year versus 3 year, as one of the issues that we need to really go back and look at. So that's why we're asking for the extension, as we will, so we can have the time. We thought we had everyone at the table. They were representing their organizations, including teachers, but it's become apparent that wasn't necessarily so. We have to get all stakeholders that will work with their organizations at the table.
Representative Erickson, to
yes,
this point.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, to that point. I think it's important that we as legislators allow these organizations, such as this administrative board that we created a few years ago, they're still somewhat in their infancy, to be able to have these discussions and debates among administrators, whether they are at the principal level or the superintendency level. Dr. Lamp, I appreciate your appeal to us to give you that flexibility. And if it ends up being three, so be it. But we don't, as a legislative body, need to tell you that. You must do that in your rule.
Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent 1,700 elementary and secondary principals throughout Minnesota. And I visited with Representative Benson about this amendment yesterday, about maintaining the requirement that principals have 3 years of teaching service as a condition of getting their license. And what I indicated to Representative Benson, I wanted to put on the record here as well, is I've talked personally to a lot of school principals. School principals really think this is important. Almost all of your school principals in Minnesota have had those 3 years of teaching experience prior to getting the license. Ms. Larson and I spoke for a moment. There is an alternative license track as well. You could fix this for that if you want to. But there was a move to move away from that 3 years of successful teaching as a condition of getting the license. This amendment is going to make sure that movement stopped, and that as a policy decision we keep this in there as a requirement. And so the school principals really do strongly support this amendment and request that you adopt it. And we take exception to Representative Dabney's comment about incompetent teachers becoming administrators, Mr. Chair. I had to have that in the record here somewhere.
Mr. Harrison, you and Representative Dabney can go to Rukavina's committee and have a discussion about the quality of higher ed instruction as well. Representative Heyer-Gerken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to speak on behalf of, again, Representative Ward's amendment. I think it makes sense. When I first started teaching, and I don't think the amendment goes far enough, when I first started teaching, the superintendent was required to teach one class, and the principal was required to teach two classes. And believe me, they had a different mentality. I like the amendment, and I like the common sense thought there. Thank you.
Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll pass in the interest of time.
Terrific. Members, we're ready to vote, I think, I hope. Ward Amendment, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, how are we defining successful teaching experience?
Representative Ward.
I would defer to Mr. Arnson.
Mr. Arnson.
On a sprint, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, that language is actually in the current rule. It does say successful teaching in the current rule, and that has been the standard for a long time. I think that's evolved to the extent that when the board issues the licenses, they evaluate the credentials.
Right.
We did have someone a few years ago who didn't have the teaching. It turned out, and the board looked at it closely. I recall specifically when then the license was suspended. So it's a phrase of art that's been used for some time. That gives some discretion for the issuance of the license.
Members, we're ready to vote. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Benson, are we ready to vote on your bill?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any further questions? Anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 985? If not, Representative Benson renews his motion. House File 985 be recommended to pass and refer to Finance Committee with a re-referral to K-12 Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Peterson. House File 1642. The chair will move that House File 1642 be recommended to pass and Representative. Okay, and we're sending this to the General Register. Very well. Representative Peterson, we heard terrific testimony from one of your superintendents on Tuesday. I think the committee is fairly well informed, but please give us a quick recap, and we'll see if there's any questions or any other testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Like the chair said, we have been here before, and in Minnesota, the school districts are allowed to get into wind energy, and if they do that, they're required to include educational programming at their school districts for that. I don't know if that got covered the other day. And what this bill intends to do is increase the amount of megawatts a school can participate in part or in whole for projects, specifically one right now, including about 14 districts ranging from Brainerd all the way down to Zumbrota, and including rural and urban and suburban districts. So with that, I'm proposing to go to 10 megawatts to make it more realistic of the technology that exists in the market, and I think it's a good opportunity for schools and for students to get trained into the next sector of the economy in energy.
Are there any questions for Representative Peterson?
Yeah.
Representative Ward.
Representative Peterson, and this is really an exciting situation to me. I know of school districts that are not in the, you know, you were here last week to talk talked about the number of school districts that were in the consortium. Or,
mm-hmm.
I know there's a number of school districts that don't have, that aren't involved in that, but do have wind generators, that are actually have wind generators within their own, within their school?
Yeah.
Is there a chance for them to later become involved in this program?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, I think if this program that you're referring to that Brainerd's involved in, if that's successful, I think then the word will spread quickly. And those schools that do have generators right now typically have a smaller one. And, for instance, there's one in my district that's been running since about 96, 97. And, yeah, it's right on the school property, but it's pretty outdated and it's a little bit small already.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in the bill? If not, then the chair renews his motion that House File 1642 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Registry. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you for your time today.
Ms. Frank here? No. Representative Hornstein? Oh, there he is. House File 1317, Representative Hornstein moves that House File 1317 be recommended for pass. And where do we want to send this one? to finance?
I think it would need to go to finance because it's mainly a policy bill, but my understanding is that's where our education policy bills are going.
We don't have an omnibus policy bill unless you want it straight on the floor, which is your option, but I don't think you want that. So, well,
okay.
Motion is to be recommended pass, refer to finance with a re-referral to K-12 finance. Representative Hornstein, House Bill 1317.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And Mr. Chair, I do very much appreciate your hearing this bill, especially at this late date in the session. This is a initiative related to class size reduction, members. And it's not a bill that pours money into class size at this point, although I would hope down the road we take a real serious look at doing this. It's a bill that simply asks for some information. We can't make good policy without good information and data. And so I'll just go through very quickly the sections of the bill, and then I have a few parents and teachers that we'll give some brief testimony about the importance of class size.
Yeah, Representative Hornstein, we are, as usual, pressed for time, so we'll need
to let me just
brief.
Quickly.
Thank you.
The first subdivision is an idea that came from Representative Dietrich, which is to include class size on the school report card data that the department has. That's currently not included. The second looks at some definitions of class size and some ratios. Again, this is not a mandate. This is just simply for the purposes of data collection. These were culled from some conversations I had with House Research and some research in terms of what other states have done around the country in terms of measuring class size. But the most important part of the bill is Subdivision 3, which asks the Department of Education to give us some information and report to the education committees about, you know, again, various things, class size ratios in districts, the gap that currently exists between those class sizes and the target class sizes that are laid out in the bill. Very importantly, what are the costs to lower that gap, and then suggest some recommendations. So, Mr. Chair, I did want to just conclude my testimony by referring to one handout that I have, and of course there could be many on this, but I thought this was very brief. You might have time to even peruse it during the hearing here. And it's a Princeton, New Jersey study that really motivated me to get involved in this issue, beside my own personal experience as a public school parent, in which just last year my kids were experiencing class sizes in high school approaching 40, and in grade school on the 35 range. And this was just simply, I felt, unacceptable. In my conversations with fellow parents, we found it unacceptable. But to the extent that we have had a theme around the achievement gap this year, Mr. Chair and members, this Princeton, New Jersey study, I think, is very compelling because it really documents a direct relationship between lowering class size and the achievement gap. The STAR study in Tennessee, 72% of students versus 66% from regular classes graduating on time, completing more advanced math and English courses, higher documentation in terms of completing high school. The data is here. We believe it'll help Minnesota move forward. I have several testifiers who have agreed to testify very briefly. First, I have Judy Fido from Anoka. And you can just sit in the hot seat here.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fido, and if you can state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. My name is Judy Fido, and I have taught in art in Anoka Hennepin District 11 for about 18 years. I am here I'm very happy to be here this morning to testify and speak in favor of Representative Hornstein's House Bill Number 1317. This all came about because of some emails I sent to my legislators on Saturday regarding class size, equitable funding, and the federal government's unfunded mandates, which I believe could help support and supply the money for what we need in terms of class size. When I learned I was going to be testifying, I immediately got on my computer and emailed nearly 4,000 people in my district. You see, we are the largest school district in the state at this point. And I received many, many, to someone's chagrin. I see, okay. The response was very valuable and important and also very disillusioning. Their emails were filled with discouragement, and I have nearly 100 emails just in one day from very, very, very concerned teachers who, again, are disillusioned. I have called just a few pieces from these emails that I would like to share with you, and I will be very brief. I'm a first-year English teacher in a particular school in our district in the English department, and I have ninth-grade classes with 35 and 37 students in them. Ninth grade is crucial, a crucial year for setting up success in high school. She can't possibly give them all the attention that they would deserve, and ninth graders this year take the MCA test in writing, and starting this year they have to pass this to graduate. So this is a significant area that we need to reduce class size, which this bill does. Students are not finding connections at home, so the connections we make in our classroom are crucial. Give me smaller class sizes so that I can individually give students their time. And there's another issue in terms of reporting the ratio of students to teachers that I would like to address, and she does too. The ratios look good to the public, but they have included in the past special ed teachers, emotional behavior disordered groups, speech, occupational therapy, and physical therapy numbers, not just classroom teachers. We need to make that very clear. Writing courses that have piled with students, piled, recurred in these emails from different teachers, upwards of 36 students. If it takes me 10 to 15 minutes to read and comment on each piece of writing the students submit, I spend 360 to 540 minutes of my time working on improving writing. That's between 6 and 9 hours of outside work. What other profession requires that? I taught sixth grade in Fridley until 5 years ago. Class sizes of 35, oops, I didn't mean to mention schools. Class sizes of 35 were common. Keep in mind that the classrooms in the state were not built to handle more than 25 to 28 students. Adding 5 to 7 desks meant there's no room. No room to move around and check work. There are parts of my classroom, she says, that I can't access without jumping over a couple of desks. And I personally have experienced the same thing in my Drawing 1 class, where we use large boards, still life materials. I had to go completely south to go to the northern students.
And Ms. Vito, if you can try to conclude, we do have 7 other testifiers on another bill and several more behind
all
you
right.
on this bill. So.
The emails repeatedly spoke of numbers in the mid to 30s to 39 was not uncommon, and 36 for lab classes. I deeply appreciate the number of 25 in the high school lab classes being that the number is limited to 25. These people are, they have 12 and 13-year-olds handling scalpels and needles and things that leave the teachers very, very concerned about the safety of her safety and that of the students. I will just, 44 students in a accelerated math class in a number of schools, but particularly in northern suburbs. All right, one teacher's closing here. I went into education to make a difference in every child I teach. Don't give me new curriculum, fancier buildings, better technology, or more equipment. Give me fewer children in each of my classes so I can do what I have a passion to do. I make a difference by teaching the individuality of each and every child I am blessed with each day. Class size is at the heart of all education issues for both students and teachers. This is where funding needs to start.
Thank you, Ms. Fido. There are two people that have questions. Is this Representative Norns? Is this to the testifier or to the general bill?
This would be to the author.
Could we hold off those comments till we have discussion on the bill?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fido.
And welcome.
Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Hoops. I'm a parent of a public school student in Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm here because I'd like to talk a little bit about how the large class sizes are having an impact on special education students. I have a lot of friends with children with autism spectrum disorders. Last year, one of them enrolled his son in a school. He's in fifth grade. There are 35 students in his classroom. The situation was impossible for his son. Part of having autism is being having a hard time around with a lot of people around you and interacting with other people. Instead of suing the school district or something, they chose to take their child out of Minneapolis Public Schools and enroll him in an online charter school, and they really feel that the child is not being well served in this situation. Thanks.
Thank you, just a couple of other very quick testifiers from additional perspectives.
Please.
I'd like to ask Becky Wright, who's a parent and member of the site council of Borough School, to give brief testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wright, and if you Thank can you. State your name for the record, please.
Becky Wright. I'll try to be brief.
Go ahead with your
Okay. I am a parent of a second and fifth grader at Burroughs Community School. It's an elementary K-5 in southwest Minneapolis, and I'm a member of their site council and work on the budget committee. When we began looking at public schools for my oldest son, we didn't even consider private or charter, and the number one reason was class size. At that time, Minneapolis had kindergarten through second grade classrooms of 19, second through eighth of 25, and the high school's average 26. During our time at Burroughs, we've come, like all the other schools in Minnesota, we've lived through severe budget cuts, and one of the most obvious sources of this pain has been our increased class sizes. Today, our kindergarten through third grade classrooms now have an allocation of 26, and most are sitting with 29. Our fourth and fifth grade classrooms now have an allocation of 32. And although in the past couple years we've had 34 to 35 kids in these classrooms, this year our school, using private funds and cutting from other budget areas, has been able to keep this allocation at 26. The cost of this reduced class size has been the elimination of our band, our orchestra, and our gifted and talented program. But this was a sacrifice our parents overwhelmingly agreed to do to reduce these class size numbers. Please keep in mind these numbers reflect the ratio of the students to one teacher. We do not have the funds for educational assistance. A quick story of one of our favorite teachers in our building. She is a first grade teacher, and she currently has 28 students in her classroom. She divides her kids into two groups each day to provide more one-on-one reading consultation. She can't fit the 14 kids around her table. They're crowded next to each other. Their books and papers are overlapping, and these are 6- and 7-year-olds trying to learn to read. 5 years ago, when my son was in this class, he had 18 children. Now it's 28. As our budgets shrink and schools attempt to hold on to essential programming, class size has become the sacrificial lamb. We at Burroughs have been fortunate. We've done a lot of things to try to compensate for these increased class size. We literally have hundreds of volunteers, parents, and community members who come in and lead learning activities, tutor students, read with them one-to-one, and many other tasks. We raise a large amount of private funds, and although this only makes up a small portion of our class size reduction, it does make it possible. I also wanted to mention that we are a school that is thriving. Contrary to the focus of decreasing enrollment in Minneapolis public schools, the schools in our area are growing and in many cases have waiting lists to children waiting to get in. And we also are fortunate to have a brand new school, a school that was built 4 years ago for 585 students. Due to increased class size, this year we have 680. Next year we'll be at capacity with 740. We are tightly packed into there. And many other schools, I would assume, most do not have all the resources we have to help reduce with the class size impact. And this issue is not unique to Minneapolis. I know all over the state of Minnesota, all schools are feeling the effect of class size.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Any questions for Ms. Wright?
Mr. Chair, I have two very brief final testifiers, and they will both comment on the theme of the achievement gap. And so I'd like to call on Ms. Ellingson and Mr. Hicks. And again, they know our time constraints, but I think they have an important message about the achievement gap in class size that I want the committee to hear.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein, and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Char Ellingson, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for asking my opinion on this issue. I'm a science teacher at Patrick Henry in the North Minneapolis, and I think perhaps my perspective is a little different from the standpoint that I spent 13 years in the business community and have only been teaching for 6 years. That entire time has been on the north side at Patrick Henry. And one of the things that I think doesn't get spoken about a lot in the public arena is that we are having some success with very challenging kids on the north side at Henry. And one of the things I wanted to specifically sort of put out there for you to think about is I don't really actually see an achievement gap in my classroom. When I look at the numbers and hear the numbers, I do. But when I look at my classroom, I see an engagement gap. And that engagement gap is a lot of students, but particularly African-American male students, they really have a different learning style that requires hands-on, inquiry-based, student-centered activities, which is exactly what our state standards call for, interestingly enough. And class size is a huge obstacle to delivering that. And so I could tell you about my class sizes, but you already know, yes, I've had 43 all boys, 7 girls in classes. But that's not really the issue. The bigger issue for me is the whole number of students. Because the class size, it's sort of an exponential effect because, you know, there's the safety issues in the lab that you all know about, I'm sure. There's the lack of materials when you have too many students. There's providing feedback to their learning, which is really critical. And then, but then the most important part is there's building relationships. And I feel like the total number of students needs to be somewhere around 100 to really effectively develop relationships with our most at-risk students.
Thank you, Ms. Ellingson.
And then we have
questions for her. Okay, Ms. Ellingson.
Then Ms. Okay, go ahead.
Representative Gottwald.
Are we having more testifiers, Mr. Chair?
We still have 2 more on this one and 7 more on another bill ahead of us.
I'll wait. Thank you.
Okay.
My last testifier is Mr. Hicks, and he's come with kid in tow, so I know that he'll
Who has to get to preschool really soon.
Okay, welcome to the committee and state your name for the record, please.
Jason Hicks, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for letting me speak very briefly. I'll try to be as concise as possible. I'm the parent of a kindergartner in Minneapolis Public School as well. We have a big Minneapolis contingent here. At Wyndham Elementary, she's in the Spanish dual immersion program that is 3 years in the running. A fantastic program, program that actually directly addresses achievement gap. In that we have 50% of our students at least are Latino, many of whom come from families where Spanish is the only spoken language. I don't think I have to go into great detail about the enormous Latino minority in this country and how it continues to grow, and that the high school graduation rate for Latino students is around 50% nationwide. I feel as though, and I know, that programs such as ours, which is a dual immersion, the studies bear out that these kids, Latino kids in particular, end up graduating at much higher levels from high school with more success than they would have otherwise, specifically because they're learning in a style that is perfectly suited to achievement. We have an achievement gap at our school right now that we are chipping away at each year. But when my daughter started this year, the class size was 33. That's gradually pared down now to about 27 due to attrition and other reasons. Unfortunately, a couple people just pulling out because it was too big. I don't know if any of you have 5 or 6-year-olds, but if you get 3 or 4 of them in a room together and try to get anything done or be as constructive as you can, it's can be next to impossible. We need to empower our teachers. We need to give them the tools. They have the tools in many cases,
but I ask you to really think long and hard about this class size, how it does ultimately affect achievement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks. We do have one more testifier, I believe, Mr. Schneiderwind.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderwind with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I have not had an opportunity to talk to Representative Hornstein about this issue, but this is something when we're talking about measuring this, and it's a laudable goal, when all districts try to reduce the class sizes to the maximum that they can. But I think when you're talking about the definition issue on page 2, I think you need to consider some of the things that that we're talking about. Subdivision 1, it talks about excluding those teachers for whom federal aids are received or for whom categorical aids are received. And so I think you have a number of special ed teachers who receive federal aid to help supplement their salaries, and I know in many instances that school districts have different models of teaching, and some special ed teachers teach classes with other classroom teachers, and so I think that needs to be considered. And then it also excludes the supervisory personnel, and I think Representative Heigerken alluded to this earlier, and I happened to be one of those teachers who had a superintendent and a principal who taught classes, and I think those things need to be evaluated before we go ahead and make a broad. And I apologize, I haven't had time to talk to Representative Hornstein about it, and would be open for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Schneiderwind. And I would assume that you would have that opportunity to work with the author of the bill between now and finance.
Okay. Thank
you. We do have four people that would like to comment on the bill. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the same section, Section 2, Subdivision 2. I guess I thought this bill was basically asking for a study and a report, but it says there that in the absence of setting different ratios by the commissioner, then the class ratios are as follows, and it dictates then what the schools will have for class size. So to me, this bill is a little more than just looking for a study. It's actually again, taking away one more local control issue that the school board would probably determine, or the local faculty. So I just wanted to point that out. It's not a question, just to me a concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, briefly, I will reconsider this. I mean, the intent in drafting this was just to provide guidelines in terms of for purposes of study. This isn't a policy bill that intends to set a dictator mandate on school districts for specific class sizes. So I think we'll just have to clean up the language because that's not the intention. The intention is to, for example, this would be a guideline to do the study, and that's certainly not the intention, and if there's a drafting issue with that, we'll correct that.
Thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, that kind of gets at my question as well. I think we can all agree that smaller classroom sizes are a good thing, and I appreciate the testimony of the testifiers, but I was concerned that this was dictating something too, and I realize that's not what you're trying to do, Representative Hornstein. Also, I get concerned setting targets are great, but really where this is always broken down is around money. It's either a huge cost to local taxpayers in local school districts or a huge cost to the state, and if we really want to achieve this, studying isn't the thing to do. I keep thinking we should take the money from studies and put it into getting something done on it.
Representative Wardville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to make a comment. We got a committee of 16 teachers, and you've got five or six testifiers telling us about the importance of class size. I thought that was kind of ironic, but I think you had the votes walking in. But I do have a question about how you're going to determine class size, because I know that most school districts, they take in a particular school, they'll take all the kids and divide them by the number of teachers and librarians, media specialists, etc., and that reduces class size, when in reality you're sitting there with 36 kids in your class, and when you take them down to the media center, okay, now you've got a media specialist helping you, but I don't recall spending all my days in a media center. I was usually in the classroom with all 36 by myself, and could you address that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Warlow, you have hit on an extremely important issue, and that's, again, why we had some of the language that we had some commentary on from the School Boards Association at the beginning, which is we didn't want these issues fudged. We wanted to make sure that we were getting at, you know, the ratio of the licensed teacher in the classroom to the students. And again, you know, we don't, parent volunteers are really important. I volunteered in the classroom. But, you know, that doesn't count in terms of reducing classes. Not that that might be a criteria, but there's all kinds of ways to you know, report lower class sizes, but when in fact we have to get at the issue in terms of the actual teacher, you know, fully licensed teacher and the number of students. So that's what that gets at, and that's a really good point, and I'm glad you raised it.
We have two more comments before we move to a vote. Representative Abler.
Yeah, and briefly, just a couple thoughts. I appreciate the willingness of the author to work on some of the language. I don't have any amendment available, but it's better working it out of here anyway. But in the definition on 2.8, it talks about teaching all subjects to children. I mean, I don't think you mean to include only those who teach all subjects, which is like nobody. But and so I think some of the technical pieces. But in terms of the theme of all this, and I know where the author is going, but I think as it moves forward, you want to be cautious as well to lock in a number you have to have, because I've sat on this committee now for 9 years, which doesn't seem possible. But we've heard about there's not enough teachers in the pipeline. There's not enough money to pay the teachers who aren't in the pipeline. And if our levy crashes, we're not going to have any teachers we can pay to hire. And so their models will evolve. And I think that your testimony is ideal about some of the classes need small groups. Some are more amenable to, like in college, a big lecture hall, and then you have small groups to talk about it. And I think that as we go forward, we need to find models that work. And I know the author intends that, so we'll just chat about it. But I think as we put stuff written down sometimes, you don't want to hamper a brilliant idea that we're going to think, what, this is what we should do, and then we're tied by some thing that we did. So, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Virgil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real quickly, in echoing a little bit about Representative Abler's concerns on the definition of the classroom teacher, just wondering if, you know, that is really what you mean to define on 2.7 and 2.8, 2.9, and how have you changed from what a teacher is defined as?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riddle, you know, I worked with counsel on this, and I'm certainly open to, you know, improving this definition. I just want to restate the goal, which is that we want to get really good data. And you know, to Representative Gottwald's point, I mean, we want to address this issue, not just throw money to study, but we don't have the information. And part of the reason we don't have the information is precisely, you know, Representative Riddle's point, is that we want to get a really good definition of who is in the classroom, and then, you know, really try to address the ratios from there. So if we need to clean up some of that language and make it more precise, I'd be willing to work with you on that. But this is, you know, as we do, kind of explained our goals, and then it got drafted in this way. And I'm by no means an expert in terms of federal aids and whatnot, but I want to restate the goal, which is to make sure we're not fudging these figures, that we're talking about licensed teachers and the ratio between the licensed teacher and the student in the classroom.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 1317 be passed and referred to finance. Any discussion on the motion? None being so, all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome, Representative Abler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File, 1852, be a pass and go to finance. I think there's an amendment to get the bill in the shape we want. Representative Dabney has that amendment. No, it's just oral.
Okay. There is no amendment.
No, he just has an oral amendment he wants to offer.
Okay.
Representative Dabney, you want to offer your oral amendment? He's busy chatting. Want to throw a rock at Representative Dabney, please?
Representative Dabney?
I'm sorry?
Oh, you want to throw an amendment? Thanks.
Hello.
It's a little late for that, isn't it? Mr. Chair, if I could please move the A070463 amendment.
Okay. Actually, this is oral.
Okay.
The script. Yeah.
I thought we were not wasting paper today, Representative Abler. If I could move a brief oral amendment, Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 12, please delete the word description and insert evidence. More in line with the intent of the legislation.
Representative Dabney moves an oral amendment to remove, to strike description on line 1.112 and to add evidence.
And Mr. Chair, that's a friendly amendment.
Okay. And the author incorporates that into his bill.
Smooth. We're good.
No, any discussion on that?
We have to vote on it.
Yeah, I'm voting on it. Yeah. None being so, all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I know we have 10 minutes to present, and we will do that. In brief, this is a bill that says that districts get to have some of these standards that are set locally. And the point is, if you have them, please do them, relative to the arts, world languages, et cetera. Some of these, and you'll hear from two witnesses, and we could have many more, but I think we'll keep it shorter than they could have elaborated. But in some of the cases, some of these topics, arts, et cetera, are the very glue to keep kids coming back to school, to give them a reason they look forward to it. They need to learn their math and their English, and that's the stuff they need to get content-wise. But in terms of what gets them excited, especially in these achievement gap kids, just to get them to show up, that some of these courses are essential, and that's why I kind of like the idea of the bill. And so if you say you have a strong arts program, then please have one. And that's the bill. And so with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers, who can introduce themselves and present their information.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Worzalek. I'd like to thank Representatives Dabney and Abler for sponsoring this bill and bringing this forward. We have exactly 8 minutes and 27 seconds worth of testimony. I know you're under time constraints, but I do appreciate our time here and your undivided attention as well. As I mentioned, my name is Doug Orzalek. I'm the current president of the Minnesota Music Educators Association, and I'm a member of the Arts Education Consortium of Minnesota. AECM was formed 2 years ago by all of the associations that represent arts education in Minnesota, including the visual arts, media, creative writing, dance, theater, and music. The group, which represents nearly 5,000 arts educators and the educational interests of every student in this state, has been meeting monthly with the goal of advocating for arts education with a unified voice. Accountability has become the most significant issue in the field of education, and we are all aware of the impact that it has had upon the lives of students in our schools. The arts, by state law, are a required component of a high school diploma in this state, and we are grateful for the state's recognition of the importance of the arts in the education of our students, communities, and state. Minnesota's arts education programs are the envy of many other states, and we aim to maintain that status. Even with that element in place, arts education programs and many other curricular areas are being reduced and eliminated to find additional time for test preparation. With that in mind, the AECM placed accountability at the top of its platform of issues. Specifically, AECM desires the state to hold school districts accountable to meeting all of the academic standards that are required by state law, including those in the arts. Currently, districts indicate compliance in non-tested areas by simply placing a check mark on the state's accountability report. Districts are not required to provide anything else. The language of this proposal asks the state school districts to report evidence of student achievement for all required academic standards that are not subject to state tests. It is hoped that the proposal will require districts to take arts education more seriously and suspend the practice of casting the arts aside in favor of more time for test preparation. I can't imagine anyone in our state who does not wish to see greater accountability from schools relative to meeting required standards and providing the highest quality education imaginable for our students. I will even go out on a limb here and guess that each of you included accountability of schools as one of the major parts of your candidacy platform. While you desire accountability for every aspect of education, I'm confident that you're wondering three things. How can we make this happen? What will this look like? And how much will this cost? Before I offer my thoughts on those questions, I would ask you to consider the ways in which you currently determine the success of a school's arts education program. Do you look at the pictures your children bring home and cast a judgment? Do you consider the trophies awarded to a music group as a measure of success? Perhaps you base your judgment on the lack of concerned parent phone calls about the dance or theater program. While those may be an indicator of a sort, our state's arts teachers can share much more about student learning than that. We can help define what great arts education is all about. The answer to the how question is actually easier than it sounds. If this proposal becomes law, arts educators and those in other non-tested areas will need to provide their districts with exemplary data and information that presents a clear picture of how students are meeting the state standards. You will note the broad nature of the proposal's language. The intention is to allow educators to choose the assessments and the means of reporting that best fit the needs of their community and their students. Arts educators have considered the answer to the what question for years. While many consider the arts to be a subjective content area, our state's arts educators and the state's arts quality teaching network, led by the Purpose Center for Arts Education, have been blending the subjective and objective aspects of arts education with great success. We are well prepared to help the state, school district leadership, and arts educators review and consider what will best indicate and report strong evidence of learning in these areas. And when it comes to cost, my best guess is that this will cost nothing. Someone in the school will need to collect the evidence of student learning, call together a committee of reviewers from within the school system, and decide the extent to which students are learning in the arts and the degree to which statewide standards are being met. Exemplars can easily be provided via the internet and the other technologies that already exist in the schools. I suppose you're also wondering whether or not this proposal will mean more work for teachers. My answer to that would be that good arts educators are already doing this as a matter of regular practice. They can tell you and explain the progress of each and every student in their schools right now. The problem is no one's asking for that information. In a moment, you'll meet my dear colleague Zane Schaefer, a music educator from Annandale, who will share his experiences as a means to explain this further. Finally, I would add that where we find good arts education in our state, you'll find a high-achieving school. And where you find high-achieving schools, you'll find a very strong school district. And where you find, and a state with strong school districts will continue to rank amongst the best in the country and in the world. We feel that proposal will help us meet that goal, but even more important than that, it will ensure that our state will be providing the high-quality education that our students truly deserve, and we'll have the evidence to prove it, too. Following the presentation of my colleague, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions about the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Orselak. And I take it this is Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Schaefer, we are a little pressed for time, so just want to let you know. But welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and give us your
Thank you. I will be brief. My name, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is Zane Schaefer. I'm a high school music teacher from Annandale.
Mr.
And my
Schaefer,
purpose
I love your tie, by the way. Terrific.
It could be for sale.
Let's talk.
Today I'm here to share our school's experiences in gathering student achievement data and evidence on the state standards. And I realize that some folks would support written tests for these kinds of activities. And I think written tests and quizzes are good for some things, such as knowledge. But when it comes to the important arts education matters, such as decision-making, skills, problem-solving skills that we're hoping that our kids will benefit by being involved in good music programs and working on state standards, that just won't work. I'm convinced the best way to do that is to watch kids do arts and then take data from that. And I would like you to know that our school, Annandale, started to gather evidence on the state standards in the mid-90s. This is a time-consuming process because we had to, as music teachers, figure out exactly what it was the standards were asking of us and then make changes in our instruction and assessment so that we could do those things. This is especially a challenging process because, as you know, music programs often have large groups. It's typical to have bands, choirs, and orchestras of 75 or more people at one time. We are now gathering evidence on the standards for each and every student, and I want you to know that that's a different scenario. We were, in my career, focused on the group, and now we can talk about each individual student. We have better ways to record this data and gather evidence now because of technology. We're not great at this yet, but we're improving steadily, making good progress. I think that the focus on standards and real assessments of those standards has changed music experiences for kids very much for the better. Some of you, I'll bet, were involved in high school music performing groups or knew people who were, and I'll bet you experienced rehearsals on a daily basis, concerts and contests. And I want you to know that most likely your director did the thinking and you were asked to continue to work on your skills. We still do in schools and music programs rehearsals and concerts and contests, but I think for kids it's very much different as a result of the standards and some very well-designed assessments for them. Students are now asked to understand and explain how the elements of music work and how they work together to create different musical styles. Teachers gather evidence of this by having students write and present program notes or by having students do self-evaluation and explain what they hear by using recordings. These are also good ways to check on student knowledge of vocabulary, which is another thing that the standards asked. Evidence of music skills for each student, remember not the group, but each individual student, can be gathered using information and tools such as my shocking yellow form. I'm sorry, I'm responsible for the bright colors. And if you could refer to that for just a minute, you'll see.
Mr. Schaefer, we are going to push you a little bit here.
All right.
You're doing a terrific job, but it's more a function of the clock.
What I'm hoping that the committee will take away from my part is that we have some in place good ways to gather evidence on student achievement for the standards and that we're working on this. This is a tool that we use to gather evidence on music skills, and you can probably also guess that this is a great learning tool for kids. It talks about the elements. It talks about how the quality of music skills, what that looks like, and it helps students to make good decisions about making judgments on music skills. If I could ask you to look at the back of that, and I'm going really quick here, this is a rehearsal plan that asks students not just to play their instrument, but to think about what it is that music is all about. What is the style? What are the historical and cultural things? These are all things that are asked for in the standard. Problem-solving skills, like as you prepare this music, what are the challenges for you, and how are you going to go about that? So it's not just a director telling the student what to do, but the student's actually making good decision-making about arts and how to get that done. There's also logs.
Yeah, and you'll have to read the rest at home. So I know we're out of time.
Thank you, we'll
stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Thank you, Representative Abler. There's a quick question from Representative Demmer and Representative Heigerton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, we have asking for a report here in terms of student achievement and that sort of thing. How is that going to be measured, Representative Abler, and maybe somebody else wants to answer this, and what are we going to do with the information? We're asking the school boards, and I got to go back to a comment Mr. Representative Benson made a while back. We're going to ask school boards to come up with a report and take the time for sending it in. What's going to happen to the information? How is it going to be utilized?
Representative Abler.
I'll go back to the problem, and I know we have to be brief. The problem is presented to me is that districts have established some wonderful standards, and they're locally developed, and they get to set whatever they want to do. But they're in some cases, and maybe many cases, or at least they're not actually accomplishing those standards. And the board may not even know. And so internally they may not know. I'm being generous. I don't know if it's conscious or it's a matter of money. But so if you have a standard, then just do it. And so the district and the there would be some way to just, even as they, if they do it internally and then judge at a public meeting, how do we do on art and music, et cetera, languages. That would be a lot right there. That could be the standard the commissioner designs. You have to have a local meeting and talk about it. And then they would, that would be a start, but that would be determined later. But the point is, please do what you said you did.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Abler, I agree with this sort of thing. Quite frankly, oftentimes, I don't know how to say this, a lot of the arts programs, band, choir, theater, speech, I guess speech might be outside the realm, if we're not meeting standards, oftentimes that gets into the instruction that's being offered. That gets into employee evaluation. That gets into data privacy. That gets into all kinds of things. how do we separate the quality of the program and the achievement and how the program's doing with the individual that's leading the program and an evaluation of that leadership?
Representative Abler.
I'll defer.
Quickly, gentlemen.
Yeah, you're good.
Mr. Arcelik.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative. I'm not completely clear on the question, but right now there's a great inconsistency about meeting the standards across the state. We're asking for evidence of student learning. We're not asking for evidence of anything teachers are doing. We're asking specifically for evidence of student learning so that we can look at that information and evaluate it and get a very clear picture of what's happening with arts education in the other areas in our state. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I wasn't very clear about it.
Representative Demmer, quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand. Quite frankly, how do you separate student achievement and student learning from the skills and the results of the teaching? How do you separate those things? Student learning is directly tied to what the teacher is able to accomplish with the kids and the skills. And how do you separate student achievement, student learning from how the teacher is doing things, and how do you keep that separate in a report when you're doing evaluation in a public meeting when you're that's data private type stuff?
Mr. Chair, I think these are standards the district set for some reason. They must have had the district set a standard. So if they set one, how do they plan to meet it? I don't know. They had some idea when they set it that they would it'd be measurable and so that's maybe they shouldn't have the standard, or if they have one, they should meet it. So people think that the kids are going to get these things accomplished, and in fact, it's unaccomplishable, or they're not going to put their effort into the program. And that's what we hope to reveal, I guess, is it makes up for honesty in advertising.
Representative Heiger.
Yes, just I agree with Representative Demmer. He's going as part of my question. The other part is it goes beyond arts. We also have standards for FIAT, foreign language, and everything else, and it could be, I don't know, opening up an issue here that may require a lot of discussion, but just a thought.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in this bill? Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 1852 be recommended to, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to Finance Committee for K-12 referral. Is that
right?
All right, very well. Members, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair, members, really
thank you, gentlemen. Representative Mullery. Chair moves House File 744 be recommended to pass. And Representative Mullery, where are we sending this bill?
To K-12 Finance.
K-12 Finance, okay. Let me make the motion, then I'll ask the question. Recommended pass, refer to finance or re-referral to K-12 finance. Representative Mueller, your bill, if I remember right, had some employment issues there, which kind of begs the question about it going somewhere else, but you have, it begged the question for me about whether it needs to go to a committee that has oversight over employment policy issues.
Mr. Chairman, part of the bill might have to go there, but I want to make sure that we get the most important part into the K-12 finance bill. So I'm not sure, because the Commerce and Labor Committee, I don't know that they can get it done by the end of the policy period.
Very well. Representative Bowery, tell us about your bill then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill was, the idea for this came from a person that I know who spends almost all his time work basically with his stepkids, as do a great many people with kids who aren't their own. And in the world now, there's a whole lot of households basically living as a family, but they aren't husband and wife. Or they may be husband and wife, but one of them is not the parent of the child that they basically are raising. And right now they run into the problem that the one that's not the parent doesn't have the right to go to the school conferences, to everything at the school. And even though they are acting basically as a parent, and the child may call them dad or mom, they are the one that's really raising the child. And it's just non-traditional families. And I think that not only for the good of the family, but for the good of the child, that the child, their real acting parents, should be involved with everything at their school, know what's going on, and completely involved. And this allows that to happen if the natural parent or the adopted parent or the foster parent agrees to that. So it requires the one who actually has control of the child to agree to their mate being at the conferences and things like that. It's a pretty simple bill that way.
Well, Representative Muller, we obviously want someone at those conferences, and unfortunately we have family household situations where that's, for a lot of different reasons, tragically not possible. Representative Goodwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am wondering, are school districts not doing this currently, or are there reports of barriers to this where
that's
people,
what I've been
adults are not being allowed to participate?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm told, that they're not required by law to do that, and some have a question whether they can.
You know, some of the language in this bill suggests that the significant individual reminds me of some of the debates we've had about domestic partner. Is that where we're going with this?
I'm sorry.
Representative Muller.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't quite hear.
Representative Gutwald.
I'm wondering, the significant individual language has been used alternately in some of our debates in other committees in place of a domestic partnership language.
Representative Muller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it would apply to that. It would apply to no matter which, whether same-sex or opposite-sex domestic partners, it applies to. Also, it would apply. The one that came to me was a step-parent. And that's where I got the idea. But I think that no matter what the relationship, that these children are, if they're being raised by two people in that household, I think that those two people should be allowed to come to the school conferences and things like that, because they're raising the kids. And in today's world, I just think it's so important to have everything we can helping the kids grow upright and things like that.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulry, is it my understanding that I, as an employer, would be forced to allow my employee to leave whenever they want to then to go to this conference? They could just present this form to me and say, I'll be back in 2 hours?
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, that's the part that isn't in this committee, but yes, it would be. It's just, it would be like the parent. Right now, the parent can do that. And this would say that, yes, this person who is in effect, the real parent, although maybe not biologically, would be able to do the same thing. Because in essence, they're acting as the parent for the child. So I think that that's, especially if you come from an area where there's more traditional families. And in North Minneapolis, there's a lot of non-traditional families. And I think it's really important, anything we can do for the kids for raising them.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mullery.
Not cheeseburgers.
No. Just real quickly, so let's say that a parent has to work in the evening, I mean, under current law, and their child is some school-related event. Under current law, the employer would have to let them go?
Representative
Mr. Mullery. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, I don't think that's for her. There's I'd have to look again at the law on that. I wasn't prepared for that for this committee, for the labor part of it. I didn't think it was for any school-related event. I think it's for, like, parent conferences and things like that, I think. That's it's, I guess, let's see.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
It says school-related activities and conferences.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I intended that to be the same as whatever the present law is for the parent. And so if that's the present law for the parent, then that would apply here. If not, I'll work on it to get it for that.
Representative Mueller, I believe Council has some information for us on this issue. Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, in law currently in section 181.9412, there is a provision for school conference and activities leave. And what it says is that an employer must grant an employee leave of up to a total of 16 hours during any 12-month period to attend school conferences or school-related activities related to the employee's child, provided that the conferences or activities cannot be scheduled during non-work hours. That's current law and pertains to the parent.
Thank you, Ms. Larson and
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl. So it would apply to that, and I think that's appropriate. If we do it for the natural parents, many of these step parents are far more involved in their child's life than the lot of parents.
So, Ms. Representative Mullery, you're not carving out new prescriptions. You're taking existing law but applying it to these other individuals. Members, we're going to take up the Hillstrom bill. So,
Representative Erdahl. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder if it's retroactive because my school docked my salary when I did that.
I sense an amendment coming, Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Mueller, I'd invite you to come out to some of the rural districts. Your comment about we have more traditional families out there is, I think you'd be very surprised coming out to our school district, the eighth largest in the state, to find out that we have many of the same situations that you're facing in Minneapolis. But again, I think the answer to the previous questions does indicate that this is beginning to muddy the waters of what we consider family and parental responsibility, and I have some concerns about that. I know others do as well.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in response to Representative Gottwald's comments, I don't think this muddies the water. I think this supports families today.
Members, if there are no further questions, we will act on this. Representative Mullery, your motion is my motion is to send this to finance and to K-12 finance, but you may want to have a discussion with the chair of the higher ed and economic development or any of the labor committees just to make sure that they don't wind up requesting your bill and then it dies because we're not sending it to places where it might where possibly it could be. So,
Mr. Chairman, I would, what the motion would be to send it to finance, and then I will
work it from there.
I'll check with Representative Rukavina to see about that issue, and then we can figure out how it would go. But the most important part was to allow them to go to the schools, and right. We can work on the other employer relationship if. That's the secondary part of it.
That's a good approach, Representative Mueller. Representative Demers.
Mr. Chair, I would submit, this greatly expands leave from employment and that sort of thing. I would submit that maybe some sort of commerce would probably be a more appropriate place than K-12 education. It doesn't have any money in it for K-12. Doesn't affect it. It greatly affects employers and people who would be forced to allow more people off to do this. I would think commerce would be an appropriate place for this because it's dealing a lot with employment.
Representative Demers, it's a point well taken, and so the motion will be to refer to finance, and then from there we can use that as a nexus to, we do have a finance committee with the higher ed and employment part that might be an appropriate stop for that, but we'll allow Representative Mullery to work that out with the respective chairs of those committees. So I will amend my motion that the House File 744 be recommended to pass and referred to finance, and Representative Mueller, from there you'll have to traffic cop it where it needs to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Hillstrom, House File 1793.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1793 for re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Thank you. Representative Gwiley moves House File 1793 be recommended to pass, refer to Finance Committee for re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee. Representative Hillstrom, I wish we can give you a lot more time, but we're going to be real pressed here, so we're going to have to move quickly.
All right, Mr. Chair, I will be very brief. House File 1793 creates a task force to compare federal and state special education requirements. It puts together a 10-member task force, and it has a neutral party come in to help mediate and moderate the situation. I have people here to testify. I will turn it over to them. Mr. Chair, I did have an amendment to delete the report, but it didn't arrive. Oh. I don't know where it got lost, but... But, Mr. Chair, I was hoping that maybe this committee would understand that I'm going to do that and allow it to go to Representative Greiling's committee, and I promise to delete that report and get the language worked out between now and then.
Representative Hillstrom, it might be possible for us to craft that amendment while we're discussing the bill, but let's see how it goes. So why don't we hear from your testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kite.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have a couple of people here to testify. Ann Bettenberg from the Mountains View Public Schools and Darren Kermis from, Daryl Miller from the Robbinsdale Area Schools. We'll let them, if it's okay with you, let them briefly testify first.
Terrific. Welcome, Ms. Bettenberg. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
I am Ann Bettenberg. I'm the Assistant Director of Special Ed in the Mountains View School District. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this. I am here as a MACE member to support having a stakeholders group to meet in a consensus format to review the state law and rules as they compare to the federal laws and rules. I want to be really clear that as a group, we are not opposed to many of the initiatives that are in our Minnesota state rules and regulations that exceed federal laws and regulations. They often add significant value to our children and to the families that we serve. With one example is our birth mandate. We serve children beginning at birth, and the federal law does not require until age 3. This is a significant positive impact for both children and families. So I just don't want this to be seen as opposition to anything that exceeds or support of this committee would be seen as opposition to anything that exceeds the federal regulations. We want to recognize with appreciation that the Minnesota Department of Education has begun a process of bringing stakeholders together in an effort to begin this review. We believe that this current group has a narrower focus and serves more in an advisory as an advisory group to MDE. We want to support a broader, more comprehensive stakeholders group using the consensus model to do this very important work. By having all the stakeholders together, we believe that we can complete a quality review. We can make important recommendations to this body without losing the high-quality special education assurances that we are proud of and we use to serve our students and our families.
Thank you, Ms. Bettenberg. Mr. Miller.
My name is Daryl Miller. I'm the Academic Support Program Director for the Robbinsdale Schools, and I'm also here as a member of MACE and as the President-elect for MACE. I'm here as a capacity as an individual, but also as a representative of a professional organization that represents leaders in special education across the state. And we're here to support this bill. And we're here to support this bill because we think it's important that we have a broad stakeholders group that will look at, in a comprehensive way, at all of the laws and rules, federal and state, and in special education, and look at those things where, in fact, we need to look and decide whether or not what exists in Minnesota is value-added. As Ms. Bettenberg said, we're concerned about what we can do that's going to produce better outcomes for students, but also make the work for teachers and administrators in schools easier to do. One of the problems that we have currently is that the complexity of some of the state and federal laws make it very difficult for teachers to dedicate time to instruction. And I'm not only talking about special education staff, I'm talking about general education teachers as well. Special education does not operate in isolation. It is a support service for students with disabilities in the general education program. So everything that happens impacts all of us in the delivery of services for children. And we want to do all that we can to improve outcomes for students, and that means we need more teacher time, as you've heard before, dedicated to instruction and dedicated to outcomes for kids. And that's why we're here today to support this bill, because we believe that it would be important to have a comprehensive review of all of this legislation and the rules and look at those places where, in fact, we can possibly make it easier to do the work to ensure that students' outcomes are being reached, that parents' rights are protected, but also that the work can be done in a more cost-effective way by staff and schools.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Kite.
Charlie Kite with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I think I identified myself once, but our association is in support of this bill. We have had a lot of discussion around the legislature this year about special education expense and costs. And I would suggest that there are multiple strategies that we need to use to get around this. One of them is to fund the shortfall in special ed funding. In fact, last night the Senate dropped almost $500 million to deal with that shortfall in funding. Another strategy is to think about prevention, getting upstream and trying to keep kids out of special ed if we can possibly do that so that they can stay in the regular ed program. And the third strategy is the strategy you have before you today, and that's to do an evaluation of what we are now doing. I will tell you that there are significant differences between federal law and state rule and state statute. Many of them are appropriate, but some of them are bureaucratic and costly. We actually have a study here that we had done by the Ratwick Rozak Law Firm, a 450-page study of a comprehensive comparison of the federal law versus all state rules and statute. And there was a reference earlier to a report. We would suggest that any report that we look at from the Department of Education also consider this report so that we are sure that we're looking at all of the differences so that a good set of decisions can come forward. I'll just conclude by saying this. We are concerned that we are now growing close to the tipping point in our society where there is going to be a reaction by regular education parents and citizens versus special education. And we don't want that to occur. We think what we're doing in Minnesota is right to serve our special ed children, serve our regular ed children. But we need to kind of get on top of this whole set of costs pretty soon, or we're going to see a tipping point and things are going to turn against what we have been trying to accomplish. So we'd appreciate your consideration of this particular bill.
Mr. Kite, I share your concern, and I've seen some of that as we've gone around and met with individuals. We do have other folks who want to testify on the bill. I have John Guthman from Pacer Center, and I would ask anyone else who in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill to come forward at this time. We need to move quickly, folks. Mr. Guthman. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Guthman. I'm a parent of a child with disabilities. I have a son in the St. Paul Public Schools who attends Bridgeview School. I'm also on the board of Pacer and been working with special education for a long time, both on behalf of my son and through the Coalition of Children for Disabilities. And I want to speak against this bill for a couple of different reasons. First of all, this work has already been done. Federal law mandated the state of Minnesota to do this very study. It was done only last year. I just gave it to Lisa Larson, or I'd be waving it around. That study revealed that there's only 8 statutes and 7 rules that are different in Minnesota than in federal law. Very few differences between the laws, and as the people who just testified said, they support generally statutes or rules that exceed federal minimums. And remember, these are federal minimums. We've identified here in Minnesota that we want to do things better than the minimum. And it's important to note that since that study came out last year, and it was sent to every school district in the state, not one proposal has come forth to change any of these statutes or rules. Every school district in the state, anybody who believes that something that exceeds state or federal law shouldn't be on the books has had the opportunity to come forward, and there aren't any proposals. There is a study group meeting right now, and if anyone has a proposal to make at that study group, it's been convened by the Department of Education. The people who testified in favor of the bill today have representation in that study group. If they think that there's a particular statute or rule that exceeds the federal minimum that they think should be eliminated or changed or reevaluated, they have a forum there to bring that up. This is redundant legislation. The study's been done. You've got it. You can look it over. The study group is meeting right now. If someone has something specific, even in the testimony today, those in support of this bill did not cite a specific example of something that they think unnecessarily increases cost or unnecessarily duplicates effort. We have very valuable things that we put into place that increase the involvement of parents, which we all want to see. We have a conciliation process in our Minnesota due process procedures, which make us one of the lowest litigation states in the country. It reduces cost. It doesn't increase cost. And sometimes you have to be careful for what you wish for. One of the areas where we exceed federal law is that our state statute rules require special ed directors. And a few of them were here testifying today. I think we should put the money that would go into this study into the classroom and not do another study. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Guthman. Is there anyone else in the audience wishes to testify? Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do think that we can have Ms. Larson do the amendment that would take care of some of Mr. Guthman's concerns, probably not the major ones. But I would like to see this task force go forward. There have been, of course, there'd be great concerns from the advocacy community that have worked very hard on some of the places where Minnesota exceeds the federal standards. But I think that to have this very fair and impartial with the mediator thing, where it's not, there's always fingers pointed at who's doing what when we don't have absolute balance on task forces. And that's what happened with the last task force when I did this same legislation with Senator Martha Robertson 10 years ago or so, a very bipartisan initiative then, by the way. So I think it would put a lot of the controversies to rest if we had this fair study where people could say, yes, we examined every place where Minnesota exceeds the federal standards, and yes, we reaffirm that they're needed, or there's one or two that we need to take another look at. I think it strengthens the hand of everybody who likes the places where we exceed federal standards, and then we can justify the money that's being spent. But I think it behooves us, given the price of special education, that we have this study and can say to everybody that we examined every stone and we're confident that what we're doing needs to be done.
Representative Greiley, I think that level of diligence is incumbent on us. Representative Heigerken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you, Representative Hilstrom, for bringing this forth, because this is something that we've been talking about for the last couple months. And I rather be redundant, I agree wholeheartedly with Representative Greiley's comments. I think it's very, very important we look at this. Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too agree, and I just want to add, Representative Hilstrom asked that if you, having been in special education for 22 years out of my 33 years, I understand wholeheartedly some of the concerns, but on the task force, I noticed that there was no special education teacher, actual teacher that was designated on the task force. I'm just suggesting that maybe that happened. I also agree that we need to study it for all possibilities. So I would just ask that you consider that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have also talked to the advocates about who they think ought to be the stakeholders. It just says a 10-member task force, you know, composed of equal members of interested stakeholders in the summary. And I am not wed to this, but what I do want is balance. I have a child in my home who needs special ed services, and I'm also carrying the bill to fully fund special ed, and I also have a bill to do some intervention services. And so I am very pro-special ed and getting kids the services that they need. But what I want to make sure that we do is, as people talk about these cross-subsidies, people are getting more and more upset. And I really don't want the pendulum to swing the other direction, ultimately resulting in people throwing in bills to undo something because it costs a lot of money, when it may not be the very thing that's cost-effective to undo.
Representative Ward, and on line 1.14, we have providers mentioned here as part of the task force. We can certainly delineate that further. I think Representative Hillstrom's comments are that she's very open to that. Representative Greiling, do you have an amendment that you wish to?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would like I would move the amendment that Ms. Larson will now explain to us.
Members, Ms. Larson will explain the Greiling amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, please bear with me. On the bill 1793, page 1, line 7, delete compare, page 1, delete lines 8 through 11, page 1, delete line 12, up to the period, and insert. And I will read this. It's a little bit lengthy, but I will give this to the committee secretary, too.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
So that the sentence would read, a task force is established to recommend which state laws and rules that exceed or expand upon minimum federal special education requirements for providing special education programs and services to eligible students should be amended to conform with minimum federal requirements. And then, Mr. Chairman, members, on page 1, line 16, with respect to Representative Ward's question, depending on the will of the committee, it would be possible on page 1, line 16, after districts, comma, to insert special education teachers, comma.
There you go.
Depending on the will of the committee. And then, Mr. Chairman, members, on page 1, delete line 18, and delete line 19 up to the period, and insert, and I'll read the whole sentence for you, beginning actually on at the very end of line 16. The commissioner must convene the task force by June 1, 2007, which shall meet regularly, and must review the January 25, 2006 report on this topic prepared by the Minnesota Department of Education Office of Compliance and Assessment, is that, and also the January 15, 2007 new IDEA regulations report prepared by the Ratwick Rozak law firm, period.
Is that it, Ms. Larson?
Yep.
Members, I know that was quite a bit. Does anyone need to have that repeated?
Mr. Chair, can I have a line on line 112, that sentence repeated, a task force, that just that sentence.
Ms. Larson.
Chairman, Representative Greiling, members, what I would suggest is that on page 1, line 7, delete compare, delete lines 8, 9, 10, and 11, and services to eligible students on line 12, and insert, recommend which state laws and rules that exceed or expand upon minimum federal special education requirements for providing special education and programs and services to eligible students should be amended to conform with minimum federal requirements.
Thank you.
So, members, the amendment is before us. We do have the special education teacher addition on line 116. That's okay with you, Representative Greiling, I take it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Great. Any questions? If not, all in favor of the Greiling amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is before us as amended. Representative Hillstrom, any final thoughts?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that this is a really good bill, and I encourage your support.
All right. Members, Representative Growling renews her motion that House File 1793, as amended, be recommended to pass, referred to Finance Committee with our recommendation that it be re-referred to K-12 Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Members, this meeting is adjourned until tomorrow.